I'm delighted to speak today with Dr. Nelly Demiriva, Senior Lecturer and Associate Professor in Sociology and co-author of the recent pioneering social research book, who's going to talk to us today about the inspirational female social science researchers mentioned in the book to celebrate International Women's Day. Great to be talking to you, Nelly. And I wonder, first of all, could you tell us about the pioneering social science research book that you co-wrote and what it's all about?
Yeah, no, I'm delighted to be able to speak to you, Rodney. Thank you very much for inviting me to speak, you know, on this podcast about pioneering social research book that was published early last year with Policy Press. So, you know, in order to kind of give you a little bit of a flavor of what the book is about, the book contains 58 interviews, really about this foundational generation of researchers that defined British academia. Most of them have started researching by the 60s. They have established their career in the 70s, let's say. A main body of their work is done in the 1980s and the 1990s. And then they kind of, you know, they, although some of them continue to be producing a lot of volumes and to be very active later on, but then kind of gradually, like they, well, in the, they were research active, let's say, till the early 2000s. So the project, it has a very interesting history that is very much involved with, or in, there is a lot of interconnections with the UK Data Service and the UK Data Archive. And that's why I'm really very, very happy to be talking to you about it, because the project started pretty much in, you know, the pioneering social research project started in the 1994 with the establishment of the QualiData. There was some funding by the ESRC, and the ESRC really wanted to start capturing a lot of the research that was done post-1945 in Britain, and a lot of that fieldwork they discovered was lost. So for a lot of these projects that were funded by the ESRC, the fieldwork was not deposited anywhere. And these were foundational projects, right, that are kind of, you know, lost for the future generations. So, you know, to give you an example, you've got here, you know, Michael Young and Peter Wilmot's research on kinship in East London. You have the two Banbury studies, and the entire fieldwork was lost. You've got, for example, the Elizabeth Newson studies were lost, and all her research on child rearing. At the same time, you know, QualiData was managing and was very successful at gathering good and you know, established like kind of data for really very important studies, such as, for example, you know, the affluent worker study of the Luton car workers. You've got the Peter Townsend data on aging and poverty and a number of other studies. So at that time, Paul Thompson, who is the main lead on the project and is a driving force behind QualiData, and also in a way this book, decided that he wants to kind of follow up the gathering of the field notes, the gathering of the data, with extensive interviews with the researchers who have conducted this work, and in which, you know, interviews he would not only kind of cover the themes of the research and how the research was undertaken and the methods that they've chosen and, you know, the intricacies of the field work. But he also wanted to kind of, you know, capture who these, you know, major researchers at the time, so the people that also had a lot of funding from the ESRC, who were they as people? So he wanted to kind of capture themes around their childhood, and later on, you know, about their families, about their career, you know, any misgivings they may have had. As a result of which, we have 58 really earnest and quite astonishing in their depth interviews. Some of them would be a couple of hours. Another one, Peter Townsend's one, is 17 hours long. So really, an astonishing amount of material. And so, you know, that work started in 1994. Paul Thompson started, you know, collecting some of this data. Then for the funding was given by the Four Bequest, by the Liverhulme Trust. ERCC puts further some further money into this project. And then essentially Paul continued collecting interviews. And some of these have been collected post 2010 even. So we had, you know, some of the last interviews are recorded in 2013 and 2015. So really, you know, we're talking quite a start of a field work for the pioneering social research project in 1994, then, you know, carrying on to 2000s. Now, I came into the project in 2013 when I joined Essex University and, you know, started talking to Paul and then our other co-author for this book, Ken Poirmore, over dinner about some of the anecdotes and the excerpts in these interviews. And that it is a real shame that, you know, not so much is known maybe about the lives of some of these people and how they view, you know, these moments of really that change their life and change their research career. So, you know, we decided that we're going to write something about this, like, you know, a book together. And of course, since, you know, we're talking about the wealth of material, that took quite some time. But I'm delighted that we finally managed to finish the project. So this is the origin, let's say, of the project and the book that came out last year.
So I wonder if you could expand more about the 18 female pioneers in the book. If you could tell us more about the pioneers that come to mind, first of all, about how they've changed society through their research as well.
Yeah, so, the women that we've got in the book are really extraordinary, I think, characters at the time. And, you know, I mean, they have done some amazing research. And one of my favorite interviews is the interview with Anne Oakley. And she was really an exemplar of so many diverse talents. And her interview is so vivid because it speaks about, you know, the trials and the tribulations she experiences with such vividity and, you know, in such a vivid and simple way that is captivating. I mean, I can only describe it in this way. And I know that on the UK Data Service archive, people can access excerpts of the interview. So I really encourage everybody to watch that interview. So she had a major influence in sociology as a researcher, but she was also an autobiographer and a novelist. So she's the daughter of Titmuss. She does her education in Oxford, where she reads philosophy, politics, and economics. And then in the 1960s, after her marriage, and she has, like, you know, her first two children. And during the interview, she describes how basically while dusting her, you know, the bookshelf of her husband, Robin, she has the idea that what she's actually doing is work. You know, so the housework that she is doing should be actually considered work, that this is something that, you know, perhaps we should be considering, like how we remunerate women, how, you know, we, you know, allocate domestic work in these various couples, how this, you know, impacts, for example, the politics of the household. So she, you know, she writes, she has many different books on them. She's written over her career, maybe like 30 books. You know, you have like Sex, Gender and Society, which is a foundational text in this, you know, in the field. So by using her own example, and, you know, we are using now, I'm currently in the process of writing an article about the women pioneers. I'm using essentially her interview. In the interview, she talks about the moment of conversion for her. So it's not a moment of discovery or aha moment, but it is really a moment of conversion, which she you know, she feels that she's capable to do this research and that she actually actively wants to do this research that then, you know, impacts on a whole host of other issues related to feminism, to the way we conceptualize work, to the way we study work. Politically, you know, her writings are very important because they try to push essentially for the acceptance of the labor that women are doing and for that to be recognized both as carers for the future, for their future, for example, when, you know, when the questions about whether women can retire and how can they retire and what pensions they can get if they have had a major caring role. So yeah, really an incredible woman that has a profound effect over time that we're still not seeing, that this is still an issue for modern societies today. So I think, you know, we can do more, you know, reading or further reading of Oakley's work in order to understand or through their prism to see some of the main issues today.
Yes, that sounds like she'd been very influential. And when did her work start, did you say?
Pretty much by the 1970s. So she publishes Sex, Gender and Society in 1972. And by that time, the sociology of housework is 1974, I believe. So, you know, this is, by this time, like, she's already quite established. But she tries to find, you know, she signs up for her PhD in Bedford College around 1969. So this is the moment that she tries, and she really struggles initially to find a supervisor. And she's very frank about this again in the interview, that she basically cannot find anybody that would be willing to supervise this work. When she describes that she wants to do something on women and housework as, you know, and yeah, and housework to be seen as work that, you know, should perhaps be remunerated and acknowledged.
So at the time, you say 1974, she obviously faced some challenges along the way. I wonder if you could talk a bit about those challenges that you just touched on and how she managed to overcome them, which kind of represents how powerful and strong she was as an inspirational female pioneer and an inspiration to other women as we celebrate International Women's Day.
Yeah, I think there are many ways in which, I mean, Anne Oakley is so impressive because she has a novel, which is The Men's Room, and that was later on televised. So, you know, while caring for her children, she also writes a novel. That novel becomes like a huge success. So she's one of the sociologists that has kind of a much wider influence. And also in her most recent memoir, Father and Daughter, about, you know, the relationship with her father, that was published in 2014, you know, about her father, Richard Titmus, you know, she kind of continues like with establishing herself as a writer, this time with a biography. So really somebody that is so powerful with words and the way she can convey kind of her message. But I guess, you know, for Anne, you know, later on, it's a perseverance, like, you know, the sheer kind of pushing forward and trying to find and continuing with the idea of the PhD, then, you know, becoming part of a variety of women's movements, which is actually quite important for some of our other pioneers as well. So we see that in various many of the interviews, women start a variety of groups in which other women was really instrumental for their career and their self-awareness. So, for example, you know, the same, it is true that, you know, for Leonor Davidoff, it is true for Sarah Arbour, after Brach, she is behind the South Hall Black Sisters and, you know, she is very influential in the building up of the South Hall Black Sisters in the UK. She's an interdisciplinary sociologist, and she decides that, you know, by kind of, you know, she becomes part of a variety of different associations that then, you know, she finds that using that experience, like of talking to these other women, is instrumental for her career and for further recognition. And yeah, and a lot of these women kind of act in this way. They help each other, although not necessarily like, you know, this role of a pioneer sometimes doesn't sit too comfortably with them. So for example, you've got Margaret Stacey, who talks, you know, quite openly, quite frankly, how later on kind of in life, she recognizes that she can have like a huge importance on the life of other of other women, and she has always tried to be this, you know, this pioneer and this woman that helps other women, unlike some of their other sociologists that have become more isolated and kind of, you know, working with their own silos. So, you know, she talks about how she's trying to help others, although, you know, she doesn't really see herself as or doesn't want to you know to think of herself just as a pioneer or somebody at the forefront. It's sheer perseverance for many of them. I mean, there's another interesting anecdote in the book. Leonor Davidoff is interviewed, and she was interviewed on the steps of the Athenaeum Club. And because, you know, some of the person who was her interviewer, Charles Mudge, was at that time a member the club. And she's really taken aback by this. And, you know, in her interview, you know, Leonor is like trying to think, well, but how do I make sense of that? And she was trying to recollect the example and was telling the interviewer that at least it wasn't raining, it wasn't foggy, but you know, she's very much aware that she's outside of that club, she's not admitted inside. And yeah, and then again, it's through her sheer perseverance that, you know, it's something that sticks in her subconscious of all the spaces that she's not allowed to be part of. But yeah, she manages to overcome this.
Yeah, so it's interesting in terms of the style that she used, but I guess there's still a lot of problems that women will face now in terms of not having the freedom to do the work they want to do. And is there sort of, what sort of style do you think they adopted? It, as he said, perseverance. Is that, it says if someone told them they can't do something, they just kept going and kept going because they knew they had the moral high ground, I guess. And eventually that kind of, if you stick to your line and you have the right kind of ethics and ethos behind you, if you keep pushing through, eventually you'll get there.
Yes, and then at the same time, again, there is this you know, the huge support of other women and for the women in our book. So there is something really very interesting, Rodney. I mean, a lot of the men, you know, and this is how the idea of actually writing something on the women came in the first place. So you have somebody like, you know, John Biner on the impact of, you know, for example, his students survey, or you know, David Butler on his televised performance, and a lot of the men, you know, Peter Townsend, a lot of in these interviews speak about this eureka moment. You know, this moment comes and they understand that, you know, research is for them, and they are going to make, you know, they're going to have a huge impact. And, you know, it speaks about their huge kind of, they speak about their amazing sources of creativity and kind of momentum. None of the women relates to this theme or related to the theme or to the questions from the interviewer in the same way. And I think for me, this was really fascinating. So they all talk about, you know, many of them would have had very traditional roles or occupied traditional roles as housewife, raising children. And they'll speak about, you know, really perseverance, like kind of keeping in mind that they could do what they're doing, that they have interests outside of, you know, their households. Many of them continued working around the topics of gender, of kinship, of community. So gender was a main focus in many of the work of these pioneers. But yes, it was like a moment for kind of conversion for them, like, you know, trying to understand that they can, and that was gradual. So whereas for the men, it seemed that, okay, you know, graduation comes, this moment comes, and they're set on their academic path. And for the women, that was invariably not the case. So and a lot of other things happened before they're kind of set on their research path. A lot of children are happening, and some of them are very frank. So again, Diana Leonard in her interview talks about hours, you know, hours and hours that are spent on childcare and in the involvement with children that she enjoys, but it's also, you know, is something that she's highly aware that, you know, men would perhaps like not have to do. Sarah Arbour, in a really fascinating excerpt in the interview, talks about how she is very aware that a woman with children would not be seen as committed researcher. So she kind of goes to great lengths, especially in the beginning of her career, not to talk about her family life and not to present herself in this way. So I think, you know, for me, that was fascinating. I found these stories like really moving and really, you know, incredibly impactful on me, and I hope on other people as well. And as I said, in the end, these are stories also about women helping other women. So, you know, for example, in the case of Diana Leonard, you know, she encounters the women's movement, she encounters the work of Christine Delphi, and, you know, Christine Delphi at that time writes about how marriage was women's employment. And at that moment, she's like, oh, I know what, you know, I know what I want to do. I see a kindred kind of spirit, and being part of this kind of the women's movement allows her to define herself and her research in the future, given that she has like a very difficult time. For example, she's our pioneer who goes to university in Cambridge, and then it's a predominantly male environment in which she also describes that, you know, a lot of guys are interested in her, and she's not quite sure why they are. She feels incredibly lonely in this environment. So she then rejoices and embraces the support from these other women.
Yeah, I want to say kind of they got to do what they wanted to do. Are you able to highlight some of the differences they made to sort of general policies and behaviours in society through their research, but also the differences for female kind of policies as well, in terms of changing people's attitudes towards females and being more accepting and embracing equality more?
Yes, I think, you know, I mean, we going back to what these women have done, they have influenced in so many ways, as I said, like in terms of thinking about what, you know, what work is and defining work, of trying to push an agenda that recognizes the labor of women. Very importantly, of trying to bring together, like, you know, the group of them that try to bring together kind of militant Black and Asian women and create a lot of like kind of parallel groups that are part of the feminist movement and are trying to push for a radical agenda that considers the rights of women and considers equality and is part of, you know, a variety of feminist groups that probably continue to exist until today. So their influence is very much still felt. And yeah, so, you know, we're talking, I mean, many of them would have worked with other women, been very influential in the career, in, you know, career paths of other women. But a lot of the interviews are less about, you know, they're about their personal and the intimate stories, rather than, you know, kind of in their conception, the ways that they have changed the world. And again, that's a the big difference from the male interviews that they're really quite, you know, quite confident, or the male interviewees in our book, they're quite confident in kind of outlining their legacy, and the women are much more, you know, also talking about their legacy, but in a much more holistic way.
And what high hopes do you have now for female social scientists to achieve in the future, inspired by their legacy?
I think it would be fantastic if some of these themes are kind of carried forward, and we kind of pause to think and kind of take stock about some of the, you know, major themes that emerged in the works of these women, and where we are in terms of these themes now. So, for example, you know, the question of housework as you know, potentially paid or recognized work. I mean, this is still not the case. So, you know, from this groundbreaking work in the 1970s, have things changed? I mean, of course, we have like kind of a little bit more equal division of labor, but actually, you know, do we have enough recognition of how this unequal structure may impact women? We saw the COVID-19 pandemic. There was a huge impact upon women that took a lot of or bore the brunt of childcare responsibilities and care responsibilities in general. And we're yet to understand the impact that the pandemic will have, for example, for women, for gender equality in the future. So, you know, just realizing that these issues have been talked about in the past and we're not there yet is really, I think it's really very important. And, you know, other kind of, you know, the, for example, you know, the disappearance of community studies with Margaret Stacey and the Banbury studies. I mean, we can kind of come back to that and think why this is the case, why we, you know, no longer really studying communities in this way. And this is something that I, for example, try to consider in my research. Is it because these communities don't exist, or is it because, you know, the focus and, you know, the priorities and the way, you know, for example, funding for different local authorities is being distributed. So that necessitates like almost like, you know, a more individualized focus rather than, you know, this broader community perspective, which I think is now currently very much missing. And it could be quite, quite important to go back to this, you know, influential case study. So I think, you know, they have had a profound impact. And I think we'll do well to think about some of this issue again in further thought.
Brilliant, excellent. Well, thank you very much for your time, and I wish you good best of luck with your future research in the area of cohesion and community. And yeah, wish you best of luck with the book in the future as well. I mean, just to end, what's next from here? It seems to have momentum. Do you know where it will take you next?
Yes, so I'm currently writing a paper with Paul Thompson on the women pioneers. So we are writing an article called Moments of Conversion. Again, this is a phrase from Anne Oakley's interview, and we are kind of, you know, we're thinking about how women pioneers and how the women pioneers in our sample have reflected on their careers and their academic journeys. And I'm also currently going very soon to launch a report on my co-farming communities research. So I've been studying like these alternative food networks in Britain, and I've been studying a small community farm that is only organized by volunteers, and nobody gets the produce, but it's donated in local food hubs that treat food insecurity locally. So that will be happening around the 18th of March. And I'm looking forward to as well to working on these important themes.
Brilliant. Well, thank you much again, and good luck with all those projects. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Ron.